Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Ani DeFranco, whose new memoir is No Walls and the Recurring Dream. And novelist Mary Miller talks about her new book, Biloxi. Ani DeFranco is a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter who has recently released her 20th studio album. She created her own record label, Righteous Babe Records, in 1990 and has sold more than 5.5 million albums. Equally as important, she is a feminist recognized for the power of her words and music and a tireless social activist. And happily for us, she's been living right here in New Orleans since 2008. Today, we're talking about her new memoir, No Walls and the Recurring Dream. Ani DeFranco, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hey, Susan. Thank you.
Well, so often, you know, when people decide to write memoirs, they're motivated by some kind of life event, reaching a certain age, triumphing over an obstacle, or reaching some kind of landmark. What made you think it was time to put this memoir together?
What made me face my own mortality? I think I better get this story straight before it's too late. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's just kind of an instinctual thing for me, like most of my creative process that kind of comes from the spleen, you know, not the brain. Yeah, I think I felt ready to reflect on part one of my life. The book only goes up to about 2001. I jumped off there because part two is just a whole other girl with a whole other story, you know.
So are you working on part two already?
No. I've never released 300 pages of complete sentences into the world. So what happens next when the book actually goes out there, I think will be a big part of the experience for me.
Right.
So I'll see about that. Also, I just needed a challenge, you know. I needed a writing challenge after hundreds of songs and poems and stuff.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, because you describe your songwriting process in such wonderful detail, and you talk about recording little bits and snippets and carrying them around with you until they fall into place. And this is kind of an episodic memoir with short, impressionistic sections.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the songwriter in me could only stretch so far. Again, I sort of that just happened, you know, as I was writing. I wrote in these small little chunks, and each one has a title that sort of may comment on the section itself in the way that titles of poems and songs do. So, yeah, I guess that was just part of my writing DNA I couldn't get away from.
Now, you talk about the music writing process as something that comes through you, something you have to be open to. And lots of writers also describe this as a state of grace, as something you're just really the vessel for. Is that how you feel about it?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that became apparent to me when I started working on the book was how different it is from songwriting, you know, the prose game. You know, for me, songwriting is kind of when it's happening, when it's really happening, it's like it's happening, you know, there's a sense. You have to align yourself under the moon and stars. It's sort of like getting hit by lightning or something.
Right.
And something comes through you in a moment, and there's a time and a place to it. And the prose writing thing was felt much more like whittling, like there's just an endless stream of moments. And you're looking for which is the significant one, or where am I? Did I get lost 20 moments ago? Or, and it's just this kind of chipping away. It's, it was like making 20 albums at once, trying to step back from it.
Now, one of the words that springs to mind about you after reading this book is that you are fierce. You didn't have the easiest childhood growing up in Buffalo, and you became an emancipated miner and were on your own very early in life.
Mm-hmm. Luckily for me, I was an independent spirit. So my family that was kind of loose to begin with and then kind of dissolved pretty early around me, I was able to ride that roller coaster maybe better than my brother, for instance, mm-hmm. who struggled a lot more through his youth than I did. I kind of found a way to use it, I guess, you know, and
yeah.
turn it into art and turn it into motivation.
We'll talk about the no walls of the title, which is so interesting.
The house that I grew up in was designed by my architect mother and engineer father, and there was no walls in it. It was a carriage house, like a barn mm-hmm. in Buffalo that they converted to be a residential home, and it was sort of like a cabin in the middle of the city. And we lived in it as though we were a homesteading family, very close. We could see each other's bed at night. It's just one room on the second floor and one room on the first floor, basically. So it was the kind of atmosphere that you would think would breed real closeness and tightness in our family, but it wasn't that kind of family, ironically. Mm-hmm. You know, we were very separate emotionally, and so it was a very weird way to grow up.
And if you don't have walls, you don't have boundaries either. I mean,
yeah.
It's so
right.
hard.
Which has resonated through my creative life. I guess people have noticed over the years how forthcoming I am in my writing. I'm the queen of the oversharing in my song. So probably has to do with where I came from.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that struck me is that work, really hard work, has been at the very essence of your life. You've done some difficult jobs. You've been a grunt laborer at a construction company. You've been a waitress. You were working for a caterer for Rupert Murdoch's birthday party.
Yeah.
You've had some tough jobs.
Yeah, right. I know. Those kitchen jobs can be the most grueling, as many people know. I used to make a good, honest living when I was a teenager. And luckily for me, you know, I'm very grateful that by the time I was in my early 20s, I just was able to do music and quit my last day job. So I'm just one of the rare lucky people who can actually turn music into a job. And I've just been endlessly grateful since.
And you have that discipline from other kinds
right.
of work
right.
that sustained you, I'm sure. Now, another thing that's been an important part of your life, and of course, I love that, is reading. And so many books are mentioned in this memoir. And you write about one class at the New School for Social Research that really changed your life. So I wonder if you'd talk about some of those books that you read then.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about probably Feminism 101.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
the whole idea of you in Feminism 101 sort of cracks me up, you know.
Pretty cute, huh? Little Muppet baby Annie. yeah, what she said. Memory is such a tricky thing. And when I sat down to make a memoir, of course, I sat down like any human thinking, I can't do this. I don't remember anything. And then you just have to stare at the wall for months and months, and you get a little piece, and then another little piece, and then you have a pile of pieces, and then you have to rearrange them because you remember them in all the wrong order, and nothing, and slowly you make sense. You know, there was a lot that I wasn't able to achieve memory-wise in time. Like, for instance, the other week when we saw each other at the Tennessee Williams Literary Festival, and I had the honor of inducting Judy Gron, the mm-hmm. poet and writer, into the Hall of Fame or whatever. And it wasn't until we intersected at that event that I realized, right, Judy, why didn't I put your name in my book? You know, your poem, you know, A Woman is Talking to Death, that I read in, it was either Feminism 101 or Gay and Lesbian Literature class that I took. It rocked my world. But luckily, at least I had the wherewithal to remember and cite in my book people like Audre Lorde and Alice Walker and Bell Hooks and all of these feminist philosophers and writers that really turned me on, you know, that just sort of ignited my purpose in me with their writing.
And poets like Lucille Clifton, too, I remember.
Lucille Clifton, yes, of course, who's also from Buffalo, where I'm from. And yeah, I never got to meet her, unfortunately, but she was a huge, yeah, just, how do you say it, a voice that unlocked my voice for me.
And I think when you're young, it's important when you know that there are great writers who've come from the same place you have.
Yeah.
Right. You know, to see that model for you.
Absolutely.
Now, another thing that you wrote that I just thought was so lovely. You wrote, "I think my one shining gift in life has been to know who my teachers are and to follow them around looking for ways to be at their service." And you have had some great teachers, Pete Seeger among them. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've had awesome teachers, which, you know, when one of the ideas I had before I really started working on the memoir was to include a series of letters to my teachers, letters of thanks. And when I was meeting with publishers, a few people picked up on that. Oh, that's a good idea. You should do that. But then I sort of turned the whole book into that, you know?
right.
Started writing. It's sort of every chapter is kind of like a letter of thanks to somebody who made me, you know, Pete Seeger, Utah Phillips, Sekou Sundiata, this beautiful poet who literally was my teacher at the New School in New York, but also was very much a mentor to me. And Michael Meldrum, this troubadour, barfly, songwriter dude way back in Buffalo, who kind of got me started on my path. And yeah, so the whole process of writing this book helped me to be even more grateful, I feel like, towards the people in my life, even the difficult people. Sometimes we make these overly simplified memories, you know, that we jot down for ourselves, like, oh, jerk. And then you sit there long enough and you realize, wow, that jerk gave me a lot, too.
Yeah.
That jerk was a fallible person like me. And I felt like the whole process helped me to be a little more humble and a little more nuanced with how I remember things. Mm-hmm.
So you've been in New Orleans for more than 10 years now, and I'm curious how you feel the city has changed you and what it gives you as a creative artist. I love that the first time you came here, you knew you'd be back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, just magic that you can smell from miles away.
Literally.
Yeah. Or is that something deep-frying? It's
right.
Magic. You know, I don't have to tell anybody around here that New Orleans is just fit for a traveler. You know, I started traveling real early and been around this country a bunch of times, and New Orleans is unique in the world, you know. It's just this intersection of spirits and cultures and histories and ways of being, and of course the music was what just hooked me immediately as a musician. It was like, well, this is school. This is like, I just wake up and go to school every day. And that's what I do now.
And it feels like home to you now?
Absolutely. Ah. Yeah, you know, and just the level of creativity and openness and spirit in, you know, and just the people walking around, it just feels like home.
So what has writing this book done for you as a writer? What has it shown you about your own life and your own gifts? It's always a journey, and this is a huge landmark on that journey of writing.
What has it shown me? That writing songs is easy. I don't know. Well, it's been great to pick up my guitar again. I really feel like, boy, there's such a grace to be able to expressing oneself non-literally, you know? Mm-hmm. It's so freeing sometimes to express how you feel in music without having to explain yourself or say exactly what happened, you know? Like, oh, I can just let this out of my body in a free and open way. I hope that the book goes out in the world, you know, and does some of the same kind of work that the songs have done, whatever that is, reaching people and saying, I mean, I think that the thing I keep trying to communicate in my songs is you do you, you know, here's
of course.
Me doing me, you know, and getting away with it. So chances are good for you. Just believe in yourself and what you feel and what you know, even when everybody around you is saying you're wrong, you know.
Well, it's every book is a hope, really. You know, mm-hmm. writing it is an act of hope. Sending it out into the world is, too. And so what's it going to be like for you? Are you going to perform some of your music as you talk about this book? Or are you going to settle down and just talk?
You know what? I am going to just yak on this book tour. The idea of going on tour with no gear and having no soundtrack was too, I couldn't help myself. There's going to be no guitar. There's going to be no, just going to be yakking, which is, I have no idea what how to make a show like that. So we'll see. Hopefully by the time I get to New Orleans, I'll know how to do it.
You'll be traveling light.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we've been talking with Ani DeFranco, whose new memoir is No Walls in the Recurring Dream. You can meet her when she appears in conversation with Gwen Tompkins, Wednesday, May 22nd at 7 at the Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets are available at Garden District Bookshop. Ani, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Mary Miller is the author of the story collection, Always Happy Hour, and the novel, The Last Days of California. Today, we're talking about her new book, Biloxi, a novel. We're speaking to Mary today from her home in Oxford, Mississippi. Mary Miller, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much, Susan. Happy to join y'all.
I love this book so much. This is a novel about how things just turn on a dime. Lewis McDonald Jr. goes out for a drive and sees his ex-wife's car, so he takes an unexpected turn and ends up with a new dog. It's just that simple. It's a moment that changes everything.
Yep. It's so funny because I wrote this book just in a couple of months, several years ago, and I can't even remember for the life of me where Lewis came from, how I started writing the book. Lewis just showed up and adopted a dog and took me, and I followed him on this journey. But to this day, people are asking me, you know, tell me about Lewis. And I'm like, I have no idea. Lewis just came.
Well, tell us about his situation, because it's one in which a lot of people find themselves.
Yeah, so he's an older man. He's 63 at the start of the book, and he does have a birthday. He turned 64 a bit later, and he's recently divorced. His father has died, and that's sort of the last of his family that was living. And he believes that he's going to inherit some land and some money. And so he's sort of also impulsively retired from his job. So he's at a complete loss as far as what his life looks like now, where he'll go, if the inheritance will come. And yeah, I think, you know, he's just kind of sitting around and watching TV and waiting for life to happen. And life's not just going to come to you when you're sitting and watching TV. But the dog really changes everything for him and gets him back out into the world and gets him talking to people and meeting people and kind of reestablishing some kind of life in a different way.
As dogs do. I mean,
yeah.
So tell us.
You've got to walk the dog.
You've got to do something with those dogs. So tell us a little bit about the dog who has many names and is many things to many people.
So the dog that Lewis adopts is Layla. One thing he talks a lot about, the dog on the cover of the book really doesn't look anything like Layla. And Layla, of course, is described within the first chapter or so. But Layla, in my mind, is sort of just like a really pretty white border collie mix, but, you know, she's a mutt, but she's a pretty mutt, much like my own mutt, who is a pretty white border collie mix. I modeled her on my dog, Winter, who's just my best friend and constant companion. And, yeah, I adopted Winter, and you know, Layla takes a lot from my dog.
One of the descriptions I love so much is what the dog does for Lewis. And you write, he'd never been anyone's whole world before.
Yeah, you know, they are each other's world. And that's really all there is to say about it. They're, you know, they're just, Lewis was completely alone in the world, and this dog has come into his life, and they spend all of their time together, and they're getting to know each other. But yeah, they immediately just have really taken to each other. So.
That's all right. I feel that way about my dogs. One of the things about this particular book is that it is such an amazingly accurate portrait of how older people can just slip through the cracks and find themselves completely isolated.
Yeah, you know, I've read a few articles and just talked to older men like my father. You know, I think older men in particular, especially if they don't hunt or fish, they don't really maintain close friendships like women do. My mom has so many groups of different friends and still keeps up with her high school friends and has all of these friendships that she's maintained over a lifetime, but my father hasn't. And I think a lot of his friends and men of his generation are much the same. And I see it even with the younger generation of men, like my husband's age, they just don't have as many close friendships as women do. And I think it's possible, especially if you're spousal relationship or if you're single, and especially older, you know, if your parents are deceased, you're sort of, lost in the world a little bit.
Well, he does get out and he does get that dog. So if you read a little bit of the beginning of this book, we'd love to hear how Lewis sets out on his journey.
Okay, great. I was on my way to Walgreens when I saw Ellen's car, a Buick Regal in a dark blue color she called Sparkling Sapphire, and panicked, turning left instead of right, which took me to the beach. It wasn't a detour exactly, but I never took the beach. As I wound my way back up the Pass Road, I saw a house with a sign that said free dogs on the mailbox, alongside a couple of drowsy balloons. Next thing I knew, I was parked and getting out of my car as an obese man shuffled down his driveway to greet me. Harry Davidson, LPN, the man said, his hand extended 10 feet in advance. Lewis McDonald, Jr. It was the first time I'd ever introduced myself in this way, with a suffix. I liked it. Made me sound like I'd inherited something. Were you related to Myrtle McDonald? I don't know a Myrtle. Nice lady. Goes to my church, he said. Makes a good carrot cake. You like carrot cake? Sure, I said. I found that all men like carrot cake. Is that so? I wanted to take it back, tell him I didn't like carrot cake that much, that it was just okay. And then he went into his spiel. He had too many dogs, and some of them are going to get turned into dog meat. He hated it, but what could he do? Such was life. His new wife, turned out, was allergic. And then he said nobody'd been by to look at Layla yet, followed by a series of shrugs and oddball faces, which I took to mean it was all up to me. He didn't say, it's all up to you. If he had said, it's all up to you, I wouldn't have been able to take her. I was curious about this new wife and found myself looking into the darkened windows of the house. It was hard to believe that someone had recently married this man. He's obedient, too, he said, yanking up his pants. Breeches, I thought, yanking up his breeches. Pants were too nice a word for what he was wearing. Border collies are known for their obedience. You could probably train her to get your morning paper. I can get my own damn paper, I said. I felt manipulated, aggrieved.
But I love the way it captures that kind of atmosphere of the coastal town and the just the air and the water and the kinds of places you visit, you know, just driving around. It's all right there.
Yeah, it's exactly what I did. We cruised, you know, we looked at the water and how it sparkled, and with the sun going down over the water, it was just beautiful, and just passing all of the old homes that are, you know, that are still standing and that have been rebuilt, and the coast after Katrina, it took so long, but you know, it's finally driving 90 again. There's not all of these just holes,
yeah,
know, where things are missing.
We're back to loving it again, you know?
Yeah.
In its new state now. All right. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Mary Miller, whose new novel is Biloxi. You can meet her Thursday, May 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, editors Catherine Savage Brosman and Olivia McNeely Pass, and contributing poets Ralph Adamo, Daryl Bourke, Ava Lovell Hayman, Julie Kane, William Lavender, and Mona Lisa Saloy discuss and sign the book, Louisiana Poets, A Literary Guide, Sunday, May 19th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Rosary Hartel O'Neill, who, with her daughter Rory O'Neill Schmidt, is the author of New Orleans Voodoo, A Cultural History. You can meet her May 21st at 4 at the Roosevelt Hotel Gift Shop, 130 Roosevelt Way in New Orleans, and again May 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Chris Walter discusses and signs The Lost History of Dreams in conversation with Terry Lynn Thomas, Tuesday, May 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Barry Gifford reads from and signs his Southern Nights trilogy, Night People, Arise and Walk, and Baby Cat Face, Tuesday, May 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Ani DeFranco, discusses and signs her memoir, No Walls and the Recurring Dream, in conversation with Gwen Tompkins, Wednesday, May 22nd at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets available at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Mary Miller, reads from and signs her novel, Biloxi, Thursday, May 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Joanna Guest discusses and signs her book, Folded Wisdom, Notes from Dad on Life, Love, and Growing Up, Thursday, May 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Symphony Book Fair is coming up soon. This annual event takes place at the Lakefront Arena and begins Friday, May 31st from 9 to 8 p.m. There's an admission fee from 9 a.m. to 3, Friday only. The fair continues Saturday, June 1st from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. and Sunday, June 2nd from 9 to 4. All proceeds benefit the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. Special collections for sale this year include a collection of books on Josip Tito and Yugoslavian history, a large collection of Agatha Christie mysteries, a large inventory of children's books, a personal collection on meteorology, and opera and classical music on DVD and vinyl. Elsewhere in Louisiana, there are only a few tickets left for the 6th annual Walker Percy Weekend in St. Francisville, starting Friday, May 31st through Sunday, June 2nd, with panels, an exhibition of Walker Percy photos, and other events throughout the town's historic district, with lots of bourbon on hand. Watch for the complete schedule at conundrumbooks.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.